Thank you so much, Abhijit and Shanta, for that extraordinary opening. The floor is open. There are mics there. Please come up if you have questions, if you have comments. And feel free, if there are more people, just to come up behind a few mics. Yes.
Both for themselves and for the teachers themselves, because when you're surrounded by students who aren't performing, you're not very keen on coming to school. Now, there was mention made of the positive effects of remediation, but I'm a little puzzled because the remediation seemed to take place in special camps or in the evenings or in the summer. Has there been any work done in terms of extra help being given both the teacher and the students concurrently while the students are going to school? In other words, can you recruit volunteers to help out while the school is in progress so that the schools become a sort of a team or community situation rather than just focusing on one teacher?
Do you want me to answer that?
Sure.
I was going too fast. There were the three different studies which do three different things, each of which is a remediation. One of them is a pull-out program where the bottom 20 children in the class were actually pulled out. The teacher identified them, and then they were pulled out and given remedial training during school hours by a volunteer, again, not a volunteer, somebody, one of these high school-educated helpers. The second one was an evening program during the school months. And the third one was the summer camp. These are in different places, different programs. All of them had very similar results, which is that the children who are behind make lots of progress, huge progress. So some of them, and now there's a fourth program, which I fleetingly mentioned or almost didn't mention because by the time I was really late, which is a current program funded by the Hewlett and Gates Foundations, which is trying to integrate this particular sort of remediation into the mainstream teaching in the public school system. So that is what's currently going on, and we'll know the results of the impact of that in about 6-8 months. So
just very quickly, was there any greater or less difficulty in arranging any of these programs? In other words, was it easier to get some volunteers concurrently or summer or evening or what have you? Or
concurrently is the hardest because teachers feel that their authority is being undermined. So they resist. In-school programs are harder to get. This has been our experience all along, is that the easiest are not in-school programs. The summer camps are the easiest. The evening programs are a little less easy, but can be done. And the concurrent programs are the hardest, because the teachers don't like them, mostly. I mean, you have to get the teachers to agree, and teachers don't seem to right now. I mean, I think it's not that the resistance isn't, I think, deep, but there is a suspicion that this is somehow undermining the authority.
Now, I know we have in the audience, thank you very much for your question. I know we have folks who have worked in, and fellows who have worked in India and Malawi, many of the countries that we heard about. If we have questions from any of you, and also if anybody doesn't want to reach the mic but raises a hand or anything, we can also get somebody to bring a mic to you. Please.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, please.
Yes, no, that's a primary school program that BRAC runs, the so-called BRAC schools, that actually does a very good job in itself of training students, and in fact the success rate of the students who take the exam at the finish, when they finish primary school, among BRAC schools is higher than the public schools, even when you control for income. I mean, so it's in the same similar neighborhoods. The problem is that, as you can imagine, the government of Bangladesh doesn't recognize the curriculum that BRAC has, and has actually tried at various times to even cut off not just funding, because they're all self-funded, but cut off access to imported textbooks and materials and things like that. So there's still a political issue that the BRAC is seen as competing with the public primary school system, and we haven't solved that problem yet.
Yes.
So these are all numbers for mother tongue literacy, and mostly the government has actually fought a losing battle to have only mother tongue education. It's a completely, I think now by now, lost battle, in the sense that parents want English, and from very early age, and I think most governments are capitulating to that. So I think the parental pressure is all these results might get worse, because I think right now they're going to now start teaching English from first grade as well.
Yeah, and just if I could add, that's one of the reasons why parents used, in India at least, parents would send the kids to private school. When you ask them why, they say it's so that they can learn English.
We have time for one more. Yes.
And I was wondering, the literacy rates, when I look at, like, for statistics, like, I mean, I'm just looking online, I'm not really a part of the global education scene. So when I look online, I see statistics saying 92-93% literacy rates. Where are those literacy rates coming from? And like, how does one navigate the field of all the varying literacy rates that are out there? Like, which ones are legitimate? Why are the ones that aren't legitimate not legitimate?
Well, I think it's a little bit like the answer to the earlier question. The literacy rate is very high in Sri Lanka, but it's a mother tongue literacy. It's not the English literacy, for instance. But secondly, and there is some evidence now that different countries have different standards for what defines literacy. And I think in some cases, I don't think this is true in Sri Lanka, but in some other cases, they simply ask the person, can you read or write? And depending on the answer, have you been to school? And that's used as a literacy rate. But I mean, in Sri Lanka, in general, the literacy rate is real. I mean, it's, you know, maybe off by 4 or 5 points or something like that. But just being able to basically read and write is a real phenomenon.
I want to thank you all for beginning this process of engagement, for raising these issues of inequalities here in Canada as well as abroad, and please join me in thanking Abhijit Banerjee and Shanta Gavarankar. Now, for a quick moment before we break, I'm going to invite up Tinka Markham-Piper, who's head of our fellowship program, is going to tell you about the poster session that will be going on during the breaks.
Hello. Our student policy fellows were selected from across the university and represent a range of faculties, including arts, medicine, and education. Fellows were guided by the expert advice of our International Advisory Board, and last summer they traveled across the world to conduct original case studies on innovative education programs and policies from preschool to university. During the breaks today, there will be two poster sessions to highlight their work. Full topic descriptions as well as bios on each of the fellows are found in your folders. And fellows are prepared to discuss their findings and their ideas with you, whether on intercultural bilingual education in Bolivia, gender equity at the university level in Tanzania, inclusive education models in New Brunswick. There are many more topics, but just to give you sort of a brief overview, those are a few of them. We encourage you to read their posters throughout their day to learn about their work. And we know the fellows are eager to learn from you as well. And let me end just by congratulating all of them on their fantastic work. So thank you.
Thank you, Tinka, and thank you for running an outstanding program. And thank you to all our fellows who have done an exceptional job. Their work is going to be in the Heritage Room, which is right off of where tea and coffee is. Please join us for the break, get to know each other, and we'll see you again in a half hour.